We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness, a podcast commemorating the 250-year anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. The series is sponsored by the Amerika-Zentrum in Hamburg, Germany. I'm the host, Andrew Sola, and I'm so happy you are joining us. We have a lot to learn together. The Amerika-Zentrum is a small non-for-profit that relies on the support of listeners like you. We spend a lot of time assembling experts from around the world to share their knowledge with you. And we provide this content to you for free as a public service. However, we really need your help to spread the word. So if you like the show, please don't forget to follow us on your podcast provider. And please leave a 5-star review and a comment. Also, if you know any teachers or students who are doing research on the Declaration of Independence, please recommend this scholarly series to them. Lastly, you can leave comments on our YouTube channel, which is at Declaration of Independence 250, at Declaration of Independence 250, all one word, on YouTube. So I said we assemble experts from around the world, and the voice you heard in the introductory quotation is that of our guest, Professor Robert McDonald, who is a leading global expert on Thomas Jefferson. Welcome, Robert.
Thank you.
Robert McDonald is professor of history at the United States Military Academy, also known as West Point. He is the author of numerous books and articles about the Founding Fathers, including the book Confounding Father, Thomas Jefferson's Image in His Own Time, published by the University of Virginia Press in 2016. He is currently working on a book with the provisional title, Declared Independent, The Logic of Revolution, and he's working on a collection of essays called The Living Declaration. So, Professor McDonald, you chose the most famous passage to begin this episode. Why did you choose it?
Well, I chose it because I think it's the theoretical heart of the Declaration of Independence, and as a result, maybe even the American nation. It harkens back, of course, to the philosophies of John Locke, who in the aftermath of the Glorious Revolution of 1688, wrote his two treatises on government in an attempt in part to justify why it was okay for the British to overthrow James II and install William and Mary as their new monarchs, essentially said the purpose of government was to secure natural rights. These are rights that exist even before government exists. Back, you know, in the primeval days of cavemen, you know, people have a God-given right to life and liberty and property. And to be precise, these natural rights claims mean that you have the right not to be killed. You have the right not to be coerced or enslaved. You have the right not to have the fruit of your labor taken from you without your consent. So, with these being the fundamental purposes of government, the Declaration then lays out twin tests of legitimacy. First of all, the purpose of the government should be to secure these rights. And when the government needs to figure out how exactly to secure those rights, it should derive its just powers from the consent of the governed. So we have a government that exists to protect our rights, and a government that is representative in its nature.
Great. You just referenced so many ideas and concepts about philosophy, the Enlightenment, consent, and maybe we'll get to all of those. But I need to reel you in quickly for a minute because we need to get to know the author of the Declaration, Thomas Jefferson. So who was he? And how is it that he came to write arguably the most important political document in the last 250 years?
Sure. Well, Thomas Jefferson was born in 1743. That makes him 33 years old at the time that he wrote the Declaration of Independence. He was one of the youngest members of the Continental Congress. You know, he was born as a member of the gentry on what was essentially the edge of Virginia settlement at the time in Albemarle County.
What do you mean by the edge? Are we talking about the western edge?
Yeah, I mean, if you went much farther west than Albemarle County and Shadwell, which was the name of his father's plantation, you were really beyond the reach of settlement.
So is that what was called Indian country back then?
Close to it. Close to it. In fact, as a child, Jefferson remembers Native Americans camping on his father's property on their way to Williamsburg, the seat of colonial government in Virginia. So yeah, he's very much a product of that environment. He's very much, I think he at least fancies himself to be his father's son. His father, unfortunately, is going to pass away when he's a young teenager, but he very much looks up to his father as a man who not only is capable of great physical feats, there are all these stories about how strong Peter Jefferson was, but who has himself kind of a pioneering spirit. So he very much looked up to his father. He very much was the product, too, of his early education. He was educated privately by tutors. And then in his teens, he enrolls as a student at the College of William and Mary in Williamsburg. And he falls into the orbit of really one of the greatest legal minds of the revolutionary generation, a scholar named George Wythe. And it was under Wythe that Jefferson read for the law and subsequently passed the bar. By the 1760s, he's coming into his own as a man on the scene of colonial Virginia. He would be elected to the House of Burgesses in the late 1760s. He was married at about the same time. And so he's really coming of age at a time when revolution is brewing in Virginia. Of course, people didn't know the revolution was brewing, but we in hindsight do. When Patrick Henry, as a member of the House of Burgesses, was railing against the Stamp Act and comparing George III to Caesar, who had his Brutus, and people yelled, "Treason, treason." And Patrick Henry said, "If this be treason, make the most of it." Thomas Jefferson, young Thomas Jefferson, a law student, was standing in the door of the House of Burgesses watching the scene unfold.
Sorry, just a quick point. Remind our audience, please, what was the Stamp Act? We'll be talking about it today, and I'm sure in many future episodes.
Well, the Stamp Act is passed in 1765 by Parliament. It's worth noting that the colonies have no direct representatives in Parliament. And so the Stamp Act, which was a direct tax upon them, was an example of taxation without representation. And in short, if one body has the power, or at least claims the power, to reach into your pocket and take your money without asking, that's theft. That's a violation of property rights. So they thought that this was a very disturbing policy that Parliament was embarking upon.
Okay, so Jefferson hears this Patrick Henry speech, and he's hearing the arguments against the Stamp Act, how unfair it is to tax the people without representation. And would you say that he had been starting to be a little bit more of a revolutionary himself before the Stamp Act? Is he changing? Is he growing up? Is he evolving into becoming more radical as he gets older and the years go by?
Yeah, it's an interesting question whether Jefferson or any of these American revolutionaries were radical, or if in some way they were radically conservative. I mean, it is a classic historiographical question that historians have debated for a long time. I think the reason you could debate that question is because if they were radical, they were radical in their adherence to what they believed to be the foundational principles of the modern British regime ever since the installation of William and Mary as monarchs during the Glorious Revolution. The principles for which they stood were principles that they believed were at the foundation of the modern British state. And so they saw themselves not as being anti-British. They saw themselves as being patriotic Englishmen. And the people in Parliament on the other side of the ocean, they were dismayed. I mean, they thought that Parliament, of course, was the seat of liberty, that Parliament was the part of Britain's balanced constitution that could most be counted on to protect their rights. And so I think between the 1760s and the 1770s, American revolutionaries to be viewed members of parliament as being misled, increasingly as being corrupt, and finally as being a lost cause. And when you look at the year that precedes the Declaration of Independence, I mean, just literally a year, if you go back to July of 1775, there are two documents that the Continental Congress issues. One is the Olive Branch Petition, which is addressed directly to King George III. It says, you know, we are loyal to you and you needn't question our loyalties to you, especially if you meet our demands. And then it lists, you know, just as the Declaration of Independence would, a long list of grievances that members of Congress believe need to be addressed. And at almost the same time, the Congress issues a document written by both Thomas Jefferson and John Dickinson called A Declaration of the Causes and Necessities of Taking Up Arms. Because, of course, on April 19th, 1775, the British had made the fateful decision of marching redcoats from Boston through Lexington to Concord, beginning a conflict that would eventually become our war for independence. And the colonists, you know, resolved that they were not going to take this standing down. They were going to stand up for their rights. And so in a way, you could view these two documents as both an olive branch, but also as a stick. And they wanted to communicate to the British government, and specifically George III, that they meant business.
And was Jefferson the primary author of both of these documents as well?
No, he wasn't. He was the co-author of the Declaration of the Causes and Necessity of Taking Up Arms with John Dickinson.
Okay, but still some of these ideas are percolating in these previous forms.
Absolutely.
And then they come out in the Declaration of Independence that we know now.
You could go back a summer before that to July of 1774, when Thomas Jefferson, as a member of Virginia's extra-legal legislature, drafts a resolution that would eventually be privately published, not by him, but by some friends who very much admired it, with the title, A Summary View of the Rights of British America. And frankly, you could look at the 1774 Summary View, the 1775 Declaration of the Causes and Necessities of Taking Up Arms, and the 1776 Declaration of Independence, and really see them, you know, sort of evolving this argument that would be made famous when Congress adopted it on July 4th, 1776.
Yeah, so the word that I used earlier, radical, might not be appropriate. But certainly what we're seeing here is an evolution to more and more revolutionary ideas. You don't go from accepting being a subject of the British Crown to a revolutionary overnight. There are all these intermediate steps. And we see in these documents, as each of these documents is written and then sent to King George, which he then denies, then there's a response, and then a next document, and then another response or no response. And all of these little escalations lead to the final break, which is, of course, the final declaration.
Yeah, I think you're right. It was very much an American evolution. And I think it's worth noting that one of the most fateful and misguided decisions that the British made in the aftermath of the Boston Tea Party at the end of 1773 began with what they called the Coercive Acts and what we called the Intolerable Acts of 1774, which dissolved the Massachusetts Assembly. And then when other colonies expressed their solidarity with Massachusetts, like Jefferson's Virginia, the royal governor there, Lord Dunmore, dissolved the House of Burgesses, the Virginia legislature. And so what we have by 1775 and 1776 are essentially extra legal bodies, including the Continental Congress. And because they don't have the force of law, because they're not recognized by the British government, the British essentially have no one to talk to. And when the Olive Branch Petition and the Declaration of the Causes and Necessities of Taking Up Arms are sent to George III, I don't know if he reads them, but he certainly doesn't respond to them because he doesn't want to provide legitimacy to what he sees as this extra legal body.
Yes, and I think it's important for all of our listeners to realize that there was plenty of legitimate and real full self-government. and also really complex democratic political structures before 1776. You were talking about the Massachusetts House of Representatives and the Virginia House of Burgesses. I think the other thing to realize is that the colonies were very much self-governing and very much had their own ways of doing business, and were pretty independent politically in many different respects. At least the politicians there and the other elites thought of themselves as being independent. They ran their own affairs, and they wanted to continue to run their own affairs. So that's another thing that I think is really important for all of us to realize. The tradition of self-government did not just start in 1776, did it?
No, not at all. I mean, as you point out, for decades, the colonies has existed under this reality that historians call salutary neglect or benign neglect. Essentially, long before 1776, they had been governing themselves. Their governments were modeled after that existed in London. There was a royal governor in most colonies appointed by the king. The governor had his council, which represented, in many respects, the House of Lords. And then each colony would have an elected legislature. And they essentially viewed themselves as having the right to govern themselves up to the water's edge. So they didn't dispute the supremacy of Parliament on the high seas. They didn't dispute the supremacy of Parliament to make foreign policy or to regulate trade. But in terms of their own internal proceedings and their own internal government, they thought that only their legislatures could make laws for them, because only in their legislatures did they have direct representation.
Good. So here we are moving through history, and we're slowly getting to the 4th of July, 1776. You talked about the various petitions, the declaration of the causes and necessities of taking up arms, and then the Olive Branch petition. So how do we get to the Continental Congress and the composition of the Declaration of Independence and Thomas Jefferson's role in all of that?
Sure. Well, I mean, 1775 is a year of war, and 1776 will continue to be. American blood is being spilled in Massachusetts, on Long Island, in New York. Thomas Paine, in January of 1776, is going to write his pamphlet, Common Sense, which is the first to make, in print at least, the argument that the United States, well, I should say, the United Colonies, should declare independence and become, you know, full-fledged states on the stage of the world. Paine says it's completely unnatural for an island to rule a continent. And not only does he go after the question of independence, he also goes after the institution of monarchy. So, you know, we see two developments unfolding in the course of the run-up to the Declaration. One is toward independence, but the other one is anti-monarchical and pro-Republican. The idea that an aristocracy of birth is unnatural, and instead the people should be able to elect their own leaders. And so you have on June 7th, a Virginia delegate to the Continental Congress named Richard Henry Lee rise up and make a resolution that these United Colonies are and of right ought to be free and independent states. And Congress, of course, you know, being a legislature, tabled this motion. That's what legislatures are good at doing, I suppose. And they created a committee to draft a Declaration of Independence while the delegates to Congress essentially wrote home and asked their provisional assemblies for guidance on this question. Should they declare independence or not? So for about 3 weeks, Thomas Jefferson labored on the Declaration of Independence. He initially thought that, you know, the task should not fall to him. He believed that John Adams, who was a member of this committee, along with Benjamin Franklin and Robert Livingston of New York and Roger Sherman of Connecticut, he thought of all of them, it was John Adams who had most forcefully been pressing the cause of independence. He thought Adams should take the lead in it. But in a conversation that Adams later remembered, Adams said to Jefferson, "No, you have to do it." Jefferson said, "Well, why me?" And Adams said, "I give you three reasons. Reason number one, I, John Adams, am obnoxious, suspected, and unpopular. You are very much otherwise. Reason number two, you are a Virginian, and a Virginian ought to be at the head of this business. And reason number three," Adams said, you, Thomas Jefferson, can write 10 times better than I can. So those are some interesting observations on the part of John Adams. It's probably worth just briefly surveying them. When Adams said that you know, he was obnoxious, suspected, and unpopular, I think he was obnoxious in the cause of independence, and he probably feared that should he write the Declaration, some people might vote against it just despite him.
Was he that unpopular?
I think he's also that self-deprecating, frankly. I mean, he's probably exaggerating his lack of popularity. But I think he is right to say that he's suspected, because, of course, he is a representative of Massachusetts. And Massachusetts has been at the heart of this dilemma, you know, ever since the British marched their troops, you know, through Lexington to Concord in April of 1775. You know, Massachusetts had borne the brunt of British sanctions as a result of the coercive acts. And that takes us to Adams's second point, which is that Jefferson, as a Virginian, ought to be at the head of the business of drafting the Declaration. Adams knew that, you know, Massachusetts's commitment to independence was ironclad. So were all the other New England colonies. But Virginia is the most populous and, by some measures, largest of the other colonies. If you could get Virginia on board, you could get other Middle Atlantic colonies on board. You could get Southern colonies on board. And so I think he thought it was very important that, you know, just as George Washington, a Virginian, had been selected as commander in chief of the Continental Army, it was wise to have a Virginian lead the effort to draft the Declaration. And then finally, Adams, you know, he said that Jefferson can write 10 times better than he could. I think that's high praise coming from John Adams, who's a fine writer. But I think it's very true that Thomas Jefferson could write 10 times more succinctly than John Adams could. And so the elegance of the Declaration of Independence, I think, is very much a product of Thomas Jefferson's pen.
Good. I want you to maybe gloss a little bit through that first point again. What was Thomas Jefferson's character like? If Adams was abrasive, was Thomas Jefferson seen to be somehow more gentle or accommodating or diplomatic? What was his personality like?
I think this reflects both Jefferson's personality as well as his realization that he was one of the very youngest members of the Continental Congress. And as a result, he tended to defer to the other members. He was virtually silent in debate on the floor of Congress, but people recognized that he was an excellent writer. His fame as the author of the Summary View of the Rights of British America preceded him. When he arrived at the Second Continental Congress in 1775, a Rhode Island representative named Samuel Ward described Jefferson as a fine and spirited young fellow. And by the pamphlet he wrote last summer, Ward said, he certainly must be. And so Jefferson had a reputation for a felicity of prose. And he was a workhorse on committees. He had, you know, done quite well working with John Dickinson to author the Declaration of the Causes and Necessities of Taking Up Arms. And I think, you know, Jefferson was viewed as someone who was well-liked, well-known, and certainly very agreeable. I don't think he had a single enemy in the entire body.
Okay, let's move a little bit deeper now into Jefferson's authorship, the role of the Committee of Five, and the general process of composition and revision. There are multiple drafts of the Declaration. As we look at those different drafts, what specifically does Jefferson need to work on, and what does he need to do to change words and passages and content as he's drafting? And then as he's going to the various committees and then the Continental Congress, how is he revising it? What are some of the points you think are the most important ones we should understand about the process of drafting the Declaration?
Well, Jefferson claims that he is writing without the aid of any other texts, and that he is merely trying to give voice to what he describes as the American mind, and to put forth the common sense of the subject of independence. And so, you know, Jefferson uses words and phrases that appear in John Locke's Second Treatise on Government. He uses words and phrases that appear in George Mason's Virginia Declaration of Rights. And I think Jefferson, he's not really claiming any originality in terms of words, and certainly not in terms of ideas. The 18th century was an era before footnotes, but I think from our 21st century perspective, we could look at the Declaration of Independence and, you know, pay attention to specific phrases like life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and imagine that that is a hyperlink. And in the eyes of everybody who saw it, it is a hyperlink, you know, to the ideas of John Locke and to others, because of course, you know, Locke had written at the end of the 1680s, but many people had, you know, distilled and repeated Lockean beliefs about the purpose of government in the decades that had followed.
Can you maybe talk a little bit more about the other political influences? You've mentioned Locke several times. Is there anyone else you think we should be aware of regarding influences from the field of political philosophy?
I mean, historians have spilled a lot of ink on this question, and it was its own cottage industry in the 1970s and 1980s and beyond. You know, Jefferson listed as his, you know, most influential political thinkers, Locke, Algernon Sidney, and Montesquieu. But I think the Declaration of Independence, we should take him at his word. You know, he was trying to put forth the American mind, not the mind of any particular European philosopher, but the collective mindset of the American colonists. And, you know, when you look at the principles of the Declaration, especially the ones that are laid out in the first couple of paragraphs, you see, you know, a classic elucidation of social contract theory. But then when you look at the laundry list of grievances against the king that follow, you see essentially a how not to list for future governments. You know, all of these different offenses that Jefferson says George III is responsible for. In some ways, there's a bit of a stretch there. George III wasn't responsible for all of these offenses personally, but certainly the British state was, and George III was the head of the British state. And it's important to note that the Declaration of Independence was declaring that the connection between the United States, as it was now calling itself, and, you know, the state of Great Britain, the United Kingdom, was severed. And so it's important to point your finger directly at the king, you know, given his role as head of state.
Good. And can you just maybe now talk about some of the committee work? Sometimes I think of this process like horse trading in Congress. Like, are we going to put in this grievance, or are we going to put in this sentence to placate the people from Georgia or Massachusetts? Was the composition process with the committee pretty smooth? Did they have different constituencies they were trying to appease? I mean, what's your sense of how this document was revised?
Yeah, well, it's only a sense because, you know, we have one draft of the Declaration that dates to the committee stage and a fragment of an earlier draft of the Declaration that precedes that. It seems as if John Adams and Benjamin Franklin made a couple of different suggestions. And these are incorporated into the draft that Jefferson and other members of the committee submit to the Continental Congress. And it's worth noting that the Continental Congress votes in favor of the question of independence on July 2nd, 1776.
And this is in Philadelphia, let's remember.
In Philadelphia. But then it takes up the business of working through the actual declaration. So on July 2nd and July 3rd into July 4th, the Continental Congress is going to be poring over the draft that had been submitted by Jefferson and Adams and Franklin and Livingston and Sherman. And the Continental Congress itself is going to make a number of changes, most of them stylistic, most of them, in my personal opinion, you know, positive changes. For example, you know, the sentence that we began with in Jefferson's draft, it said that they are endowed by their creator with inherent and inalienable rights. That was changed by Congress to they are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. So there are a number of instances where the prose is tweaked or tightened. But of course, there's one substantive change, and we'd probably be remiss if we were to glide past it. there's a long paragraph. It's really the crescendo of Jefferson's argument in his list of grievances against the king that takes aim at both slavery and the slave trade. And this is struck from the Declaration by Congress. According to Jefferson, the delegates from South Carolina and Georgia essentially said, if this paragraph remains in, you can count us out. And, you know, that's a truly poignant moment, because at the moment of America's birth, the issue of slavery possessed the power to lead to the end of American union. And at the moment of America's birth, the Continental Congress decided that it was going to glide past this issue of slavery and remove this long paragraph from the draft that Jefferson had submitted. And it's a shame in a way, because it's a very powerful critique of slavery in the slave trade. In Jefferson's long paragraph, just the beginning of it, Jefferson writes, he, meaning the king, George III, he has waged cruel war against human nature itself, violating its most sacred rights of life and liberty in the persons of a distant people who never offended him, captivating and carrying them into slavery in another hemisphere, or to incur miserable death in their transportation thither. Of course, Jefferson's referring to the middle passage. This piratical warfare, the opprobrium of infidel powers, is the warfare of the Christian king of Great Britain, determined to keep open a market where men should be bought and sold.
We had a little recording glitch here. Professor MacDonald said, quote, Jefferson, in this paragraph, refers to these African men, women, and children as men. And in his draft, he puts that word in all caps, capital M, capital E, capital N. So lest anyone believe that the claim Jefferson makes in the beginning of the Declaration that all men are created equal is a reference merely to males, he's clearly referring to all mankind. That's the sense in which he uses this word to refer both to people generally in the second paragraph of the Declaration and that famous statement of equality and liberty. It's also the way that he refers to the men, women, and children who were taken against their will from Africa and brought to the New World in chains. And now back to my next question. Professor MacDonald, what do you think Thomas Jefferson thought of that removal? Obviously, no one was going to fight it on the floor of Congress. Do we get a sense of his own personal feelings after the fact? Did he ever write about it in his diary or in his letters?
Boy, did he. He was a wounded author. He had some thin skin. Jefferson made handwritten copies of the Declaration as adopted, which he put alongside his original draft of the Declaration. And he sent these side-by-side comparisons to several different people, including, you know, his mentor and fellow member of the Continental Congress, George Wythe. You know, he very much wanted people to tell him what he believed, which is that his version of the Declaration was far superior to the version as adopted by the Continental Congress. I think in terms of style as well as substance, you know, regarding the slave trade, Jefferson was, you know, he very much felt some ownership of this document, and he was very disappointed that, you know, anything had been changed.
What about Adams? Adams was an abolitionist at that point, or is it too early in history to start using the word abolitionist to describe anti-slavery sentiments at the time?
I understand the word abolitionist to mean someone who's calling for the immediate end of slavery. John Adams and many people who were members of the Continental Congress were anti-slavery. Many are going to adopt the principle of gradual emancipation. I think it's worth pointing out that Thomas Jefferson, even though he owns, at the time that he writes the Declaration of Independence, about 200 men, women, and children, you know, he was a leading anti-slavery advocate in Virginia. One of his first public acts as a member of the House of Burgesses in 1769 was to co-sponsor a piece of legislation that would have made it legal for Virginians to voluntarily manumit their slaves. That measure failed, however, and Jefferson was shouted down by the fellow members of the House of Burgesses as an enemy of Virginia for even contemplating such a thing. It was one thing to buy and sell slaves. It was another thing to liberate them. And of course, there were a number of people in Virginia and elsewhere who had a deep fear of free African Americans, you know, walking around, not only because that would upset, you know, the pretty clear and crisp line that used color as a marker of slavery or freedom, but also I think because there was a fear that emancipated African Americans could easily help to coordinate and lead uprisings of enslaved individuals.
And didn't the British try to take advantage of that? I'm trying to remember a history lesson from elementary school about 35 years ago. I seem to remember a British governor or commander trying to suggest that any enslaved person joining the British Army would be then emancipated by King George.
Absolutely. Yeah, you're thinking of Lord Dunmore, who was the last royal governor of Virginia. So in 1775, Dunmore issues a proclamation saying that if any enslaved people are enslaved on the plantations of people resisting the British government, if they can run away and get behind the lines of the British Army and serve the British Army, Dunmore promised them their freedom at the end of the conflict. I think it's probably fair to look at that less as a sincere attempt on Dunmore's part to emancipate anyone. I think it was more of a threat to the Virginia gentry. You know, they very much feared slave uprisings, as we've pointed out. They were horrified at the thought that they might be fighting the British with one hand and fighting their own enslaved populations with another. And while Dunmore, I believe, thought that this would cause Virginians to back down and cause cooler heads to prevail in the contest between Great Britain and its American colonies, I think it had the opposite effect. I think the fact that the royal governor of Virginia was threatening to use their slaves against them and put their own lives at risk and take away their human property was yet another example of the sort of, in their eyes, tyrannical rule that they'd been subjected to for a dozen years or more. And Jefferson, I should point out too, references this in that long paragraph against slavery in the slave trade.
Yeah, and regrettably, it was removed. We could do counterfactual history, but one does wonder what would have happened if that passage stayed in the final Declaration of Independence.
It certainly would have accelerated what I think was a dawning realization on the part of Americans that slavery was anathema to the principles on which their nation was founded.
Yeah, and perhaps it's worth noting that prior to independence, there really wasn't much of anything done in America to chip away at the institution of slavery. But as soon as 1776 comes and goes, we see a number of measures being taken. Vermont is not yet a state, but in 1777, it will adopt the Constitution outlining slavery. Massachusetts will be done with slavery in 1783 as a result of a state Supreme Court decision. Connecticut and Rhode Island are going to pass gradual emancipation bills in 1784. And they're going to be followed by New York and Pennsylvania and New Jersey. And had Jefferson gotten his way, Virginia would have adopted a gradual emancipation bill. So yeah, it's complicated.
Also in 1784, Jefferson is a member of Congress under the Articles of Confederation, America's first constitution. And he proposes a measure. This is after our victory in the War for Independence and the Treaty of Paris, which acknowledges as American territory all the land west of the Appalachian Mountains, east of the Mississippi River, from the Great Lakes, almost all the way south to the Gulf of Mexico. In Jefferson's Ordinance of 1784, all of that territory would have been free of slavery. And yet Jefferson's measure failed by just one vote. So when you think about forks in the road, that certainly is an important one, because had Jefferson's measure passed, the future states of Kentucky, Tennessee, Alabama, Mississippi, and then presumably Louisiana and Missouri and Arkansas and Texas, they would have been free of slavery as well.
Good. You wanted to discuss some common misinterpretations of the Declaration, and you discussed the first one, that Jefferson had this very strongly worded passage about slavery in the Declaration that was rejected by Congress. But why don't you talk about some other misinterpretations before we think about Thomas Jefferson and the image people had of him in his own time? So maybe just start with some misinterpretations, please.
Sure. So we've already noted there's the common charge that the Declaration of Independence, when it declared that all men are created equal, was referring to males. And it really wasn't. It was referring to mankind. So I think it's important for people to note that. But in noting that, of course, the Declaration opens itself up to seeming hypocrisy, especially if one misunderstands what it meant when it said that all men are created equal. It says all men are created equal in terms of their the fact that they have certain God-given and inalienable rights. So these inalienable rights are natural rights that all human beings enjoy. They're not acknowledged by government. They're inherent in our humanity. And as we've noted, you know, they include the right to life, the right not to be killed, the right to liberty, the right not to be enslaved, and the right to property, the right not to have the sweat of your brow, the fruit of your labor, taken from you without your consent.
I want to pause right there. Sorry. The pursuit of happiness. Do you think that we should really understand that word happiness really as a reference to the protection of property? So not life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, but life, liberty, and the pursuit of property? Or are you arguing that the pursuit of happiness includes property and maybe some other concepts like safety and the ability to direct one's affairs or what? But why happiness?
Jefferson didn't invent happiness as this new umbrella term. It's something that appeared in many documents that were familiar to the British North American colonists for decades prior to 1776. There's a book written in 1992 by a late Stanford American Studies professor named Jay Fliegelman. And his book is titled Declaring Independence.
Here, once again, we had a short microphone fail. Professor McDonald said, in some ways, it's a stunning book because he shows that Jefferson's declaration was written to be read aloud. Jefferson believed that there were certain ways of saying things, certain ways of emphasizing words, phrases, certain rhythms, certain cadences, certain patterns of emphasis that had a natural appeal to the human ear. And indeed, a book on oratory that Jefferson owned said as much. And it said that if you are writing something and you really want to make it compelling, you should think not only about what it argues, you should think about how it sounds. And you should take a note of where someone reading it aloud should pause, where someone should provide emphasis with a certain number, certain types of symbols, or whatever. And it's quite interesting because there is an early proof copy of the Declaration of Independence, the famous Dunlap engraving. John Dunlap was a Philadelphia printer who made the first printed copies of the Declaration of Independence. Back to the professor's audio.
Well, in the proof copy that Dunlap produced, for the longest time, it has, you know, mystified people because there are all these strange-seeming apostrophes and quotation marks that are littered throughout the text. And these very much approximate the symbols that Jefferson's book told him that he should use to mark where emphasis should be given when reading something aloud, where one should pause, where one should speed up. And so it seems evident that Jefferson had an early draft of the Declaration that he had marked up in this way, and that draft was given to John Dunlap to make this proof copy of the Declaration, and that Dunlap erred in transcribing this, you know, too literally. What is the point of all this? It's that maybe Jefferson used the phrase life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness rather than life, liberty, and property, not because of any great point of political theory, but because it simply sounded better.
Dramatic effect, yeah, and especially if he was imagining that this document would be read out loud in public squares throughout the colonies. then obviously he'd be thinking about its, as we would now say, its media resonance or its tweetability. Okay, any other misinterpretations you want to highlight?
So while the Declaration of Independence asserted that all mankind possessed equal natural rights, it never would have made the assertion, and it didn't make the assertion, that all men, let alone all men, women, and children, should possess equal civil rights. I mean, the Declaration of Independence is a statement by the Continental Congress for the colonies. It is a body that has, you know, very little power over the way that the colonies, soon to become states, govern themselves. And, you know, I think the vast majority of people, including the most liberty-loving people in the 18th century, didn't imagine that civil rights would be accorded to even men who didn't own a sufficient amount of land qualify them to vote, for example, let alone women or a people of various sorts. So the Declaration is really silent on the question of civil rights. And just to be clear to your audience, by civil rights, I mean not natural rights that exist before a government is created, but the sort of participatory rights that one exists as a citizen or a subject of a government. So rights like the right to a trial by jury, or the right to vote, or the right to sue your neighbor in court. You know, the Declaration isn't speaking about the process by which we should govern ourselves. It's talking instead about the purpose for which we should be governing ourselves. And that purpose is to secure natural rights like life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness.
Great. So those are three, I won't call them misinterpretations, but I think we now have three important, maybe critical perspectives to carry with us as we move forward to our next episodes about the Declaration of Independence. First, we had this concept that, in fact, there was a very strong condemnation of slavery in the very first draft, which was removed by Congress. Second, we need to remember that the document has a huge performative or dramatic aspect. And Jefferson was writing not just for studying, but for dramatic effect, for being read aloud, for being performed in public. And the third point you just made is also extremely important. It's a limited document. It's limited to an assertment of some basic rights. But once you get into fine details, you can't expect any real complexity from the Declaration. Okay, so why don't you discuss a final point before we conclude? Can you just talk about Thomas Jefferson's reputation after he wrote the Declaration? What did early Americans think of this man who wrote this incredible document at the age of 33?
Well, one thing that might surprise you, it certainly surprised me when I discovered this. In 1776, Americans really didn't think about Thomas Jefferson as author of the Declaration of Independence at all. You know, this document is issued in behalf of the 13 United Colonies and in Congress assembled. It is a group statement by the Continental Congress for these self-proclaimed newly independent states. It really does nothing. It adds nothing to the stature of the Declaration to associate it in any way with this obscure 33-year-old Virginian named Thomas Jefferson. And I think given the political culture of the time, people would have been very surprised if any deal was made of, you know, who exactly put pen to paper and acted as its draftsman. I mean, this is an era where political speech is oftentimes written anonymously, other times written under pseudonyms. There is this general Enlightenment notion that what makes an argument sound and what gives an argument authority is not the individual who serves as its author, but instead the argument that it advances, the logic of its argument, the quality of its evidence. And so the Declaration of Independence, I think, is a document that should, you know, be viewed within the context of 18th century political speech. It's not really surprising that, you know, most people didn't ask, wow, who wrote those words? You know, the Continental Congress told them whose words they represented and who the authority was behind those. It was, you know, the 13 United States of America in Congress assembled. And so what's really interesting is that the first public utterance that Jefferson was the author of the Declaration, or maybe I should be more specific, that his hand drew the words of the Declaration came in a 1783 sermon by the president of Yale, Ezra Stiles, who said that it was, you know, Thomas Jefferson of Virginia who poured the soul of a continent into his monumental Declaration of Independence. And there are a couple of references that appear here and there in newspapers in the 1780s and early 1790s to the effect that Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration. I mean, it wasn't a secret. Certainly the members of Congress knew it. Certainly they knew that he was the person who had taken the lead on that committee of five members charged with drafting it. But it really wasn't until the presidential election of 1796, when America, of course, had adopted its new constitution, that Americans essentially put forth as their candidates Federalist John Adams and Republican Thomas Jefferson. And the Federalist Party, you know, which of course was led by Adams as well as Alexander Hamilton, Washington's first Treasury Secretary, they charged that Thomas Jefferson was frankly less of an American revolutionary than a French revolutionary. Of course, the French Revolution by this point had been brewing for several years. It had spun dangerously out of control. And they tried to tar Thomas Jefferson as a French revolutionary who, you know, should he gain power, would import the reign of terror to the United States. It's just too easy, and I think just too tempting, for Jefferson's Republican allies to respond to that sort of charge with this simple fact. Oh, yeah, you say that our guy is not an authentic American revolutionary? Well, check it out. He wrote the Declaration of Independence. You know, this philosophy to which we all subscribe flowed from Thomas Jefferson's. And so it's really after the election of 1796 that Jefferson becomes widely known as the draftsman of the Declaration of Independence. And really not until we get into the 19th century, I think, when the concept of authorship begins to change, and authorship comes to be seen as this act of sort of individual creation, that people begin to use the word author to describe Jefferson's role.
That's yet another wonderful point to add to all of the other points that you made earlier today. The ideas expressed in the Declaration are so inherently persuasive and aspirational and compelling that in some respects it is irrelevant who wrote them, right? On the other hand, someone did write them, and that's really interesting to think about also. Robert, as we come to a close here, I ask all of my guests to reflect on the 250-year anniversary. So here you are, an expert on Thomas Jefferson, celebrity author. What message should we take away from the Declaration 250 years after Jefferson wrote it?
To me, it's that the principles set forth by the Declaration of Independence are not only a product of their time, but in a larger sense, I think they're enduring and timeless. You know, just as the principles of the Glorious Revolution of 1688 are going to come in handy in 1776, I think that the Declaration of Independence is a lamp by which people in America and abroad, you know, can shed light upon the political world around them. Are people's natural rights being protected? Are the governed allowed to consent to the means by which those rights are protected? Are governments violating their natural rights? I think these are going to endure as important questions that all people are going to want to continue to try to answer so long as people mean to be free.
Professor Robert McDonald, thank you very much.
Thank you, Andy. It was a pleasure.
If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, why don't you visit us at our website, americacentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The Americacentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the Americacentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americancentrum.de. Thanks for listening.